From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Haitians struggling to survive amidst continued U.S. destabilization policies. Also, we feature our weekly frontline news report from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barris Friedman. And Trump 2.0 leads to the arrest of another American citizen. In fact, a toddler, a mother, and a grandmother are hauled off to an immigration center, apparently because they were speaking Spanish, even though they're American citizens. Can you imagine? Arrested for speaking Spanish. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Later on in this broadcast, we'll be speaking with Professor Ron Lopez of Sonoma State University about struggles going on there. And obviously, we're going to get into the expanding program of organized racism by the current administration. There's a lot to talk about. And then we're going to take a look as well at what's going on in Haiti. We begin, as we do on Thursdays now, with the newscast that is brought to you from the Electronic Intifada, and it's hosted by Nora Barris Friedman. It's what's been going on in Gaza and the occupation over the last week or so. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barris Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 12 of the ceasefire after 471 days of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon. Palestinians who have spent the last 15 months displaced from their homes and communities in Gaza have begun to return. On Wednesday, the Gaza government media office stated that more than 500,000 forcibly displaced persons have returned to the northern governorates since the withdrawal on Monday of Israeli occupation forces from the Netzarim corridor, which split Gaza in half. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud, reporting from Gaza City on Wednesday, said that, quote, "Everything has been destroyed, from the public facilities to the residential buildings. There's nothing left. There are areas we spent over half an hour driving by where all we saw was sheer destruction," he added. "Entire residential neighborhoods have been wiped off the map. In some areas, there are no signs of destroyed homes at all, as everything was completely bulldozed. Not even the rubble exists anymore. We also saw some families returning to homes that are damaged. They stood in front of the homes for hours, wondering where and how to start. The joy of returning to northern Gaza has faded away in the face of the massive heartbreak and disappointment. As people return to their homes, or what is left of their homes, in northern Gaza, civil defense and paramedic crews say they continue to retrieve the decomposed remains of Palestinians in multiple locations along the coastal road that had been occupied and closed by Israeli forces. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said that it had recovered at least 14 bodies on the road, and the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 59 bodies of people killed in previous Israeli attacks have been recovered from the rubble on Wednesday alone. More than 400 bodies have been retrieved since the January 19th ceasefire. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have continued to attack Palestinians in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent reported on Wednesday that Israeli snipers shot at one of the ambulances while it was, quote, "carrying out an urgent mission in the Tel Sultan area west of Rafah in the south." The United Nations stated that on Monday, January 27th, a girl was killed and others injured when an animal-driven cart was hit on Al-Rashid Road, northwest of An-Nusayrat, while returning towards the north. On the same day, the UN says a man was reportedly killed and others injured when a bulldozer was hit in Al-Nuairi area, northwest of Nusayrat. Abu Bakr Abed, reporting for Drop Site News, writes that more than 80 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire began, including 49 in Rafah alone. Dr. Zahar Al-Wahidi, the Palestinian Health Ministry's information director, told Abu Bakr and Drop Site News that, quote, "We need caterpillars and bulldozers to clear up the wreckage and recover these corpses. People are getting back to literally nothing. Rafah is destroyed and the killing and bombing continue there. Nearly 700 bodies are still trapped under the rubble in Rafah. Retrieving them mainly depends on allowing this essential machinery that can help with this cumbersome mission." The Gaza government media office reported on January 28th that civil security crews have worked to neutralize dangerous remnants of Israeli weaponry across the Gaza Strip. Quote, "Specialized teams have made strenuous efforts over the past days to remove unexploded ordnance and missiles and secure residential areas, which contributed to reducing potential risks to the lives of civilians, especially children who are exposed to these remnants while playing in the affected areas," the media office stated. The steady flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the work of local mutual aid organizations are providing life-saving supplies for Palestinians starved and sickened by Israel's genocidal siege. 14 Turkish aid ships carrying more than 870 tons of supplies, power generators, portable toilets, and thousands of tents and blankets arrived at the Arish port in Egypt on Wednesday. The Egyptian government said that the Rafah border crossing is set to reopen within days and that the Egyptian side of the crossing is ready for operation. North Sinai Governor Khaled Mojawer told the Anadolu news agency that, quote, "The problem lies with the Palestinian side due to the damage caused by the Israeli military operations. The Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing has been forcibly closed and destroyed by Israel since early May." The World Food Program stated that it brought more food to people in Gaza during the first 4 days of the ceasefire than what it could previously dispatch on average per month. The UN reports that on Tuesday, January 28th, 13 of its supported bakeries began operating at full capacity, 8 in Deir al-Balah and 5 in Khan Yunus. These include 8 bakeries that had previously closed due to flour shortages and 5 new ones, the UN added. The Samir Project, a local mutual aid organization, said their volunteers distributed 51,000 liters of fresh water in Jabalia and Gaza City on Wednesday and provided free transportation to around 500 people returning from the south to the north. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said that it had significantly scaled up its humanitarian operations in Gaza since the ceasefire began, including delivering more than 500,000 food parcels in just 9 days. The agency said on Wednesday that nearly 370 pallets of essential medications, including insulin syringes sufficient for over 17,000 people suffering from diabetes for 8 months, as well as laboratory and dental supplies, have also been dispatched to UNRWA-run health facilities, including in Deir al-Balah, Nusayrat, Al-Mawasi, and the Beach Health Center in Gaza Governorate, where services have been restored this week. More than 1,000 UNRWA healthcare providers have held appointments with nearly 14,000 patients and have supported solid waste collection efforts in 4 Gaza municipalities. UNRWA has also distributed hygiene items, potable and domestic water and shelter supplies, such as tarpaulins and blankets, to hundreds of families across Gaza, while about 22,000 tents are in the pipeline ready to enter the Strip. However, the Israeli Knesset activated legislation it passed last month to order the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, to cease operations as of today. Philippe Lazzarini, UNRWA's Commissioner General, spoke to the UN Security Council on Tuesday, saying that, quote, "Full implementation of the Knesset legislation will be disastrous. In Gaza, undermining UNRWA's operations will compromise the international humanitarian response. It will degrade the capacity of the United Nations just when humanitarian assistance must be scaled up significantly. This will only worsen the already catastrophic living conditions of millions of Palestinians. As of this broadcast, UNRWA says that it has not received any official communication on how the Israeli parliament's bills banning UNRWA will be implemented. We'll have more on Israel's attempts to undermine the agency in the coming weeks. The spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, Asim Al-Nabi, who is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, reported that municipal engineers and workers have been assessing the damage to the city's water networks and planning the repairs as people return to the north. The water supply is only reaching 40% of the city's total area, Anabi stated, and the amount of water available to residents is extremely limited and falls far short of meeting their basic needs. Water networks have suffered severe damage, he added, and 75% of the central water wells have been damaged during the war. However, the delivery of fuel, which Israel had heavily restricted during the last 15 months, is helping to operate some of the sewage systems and water sources. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says that its delivery of 10,000 liters of fuel has enabled the Palestinian Water Authority to resume operation of sewage pumps and water wells in North Gaza for the first time in 3 months. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of A Graveyard of Stones by Rasha Abu Jalal, writing from Gaza. Rasha profiles three Palestinians who are returning or preparing to return to their homes in the north or in the south after more than a year of forced displacement. She writes, quote, "On the roof of a cart piled high with children and luggage, Isam Abu Maher, 39, stared at the long road ahead of him. Abu Maher was heading back to see his hometown of Huza, east of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, from where he had been forced to leave, along with all Huza's residents, in December 2023. Everyone on board the vehicle on January 20th seemed happy that their displacement was over and the road to Huza was crowded. But as soon as Abu Maher's vehicle arrived in the town, joy turned into shock. The devastation was beyond imagination. Streets had been bulldozed, homes had been completely destroyed, and piles of rubble were everywhere. Abu Maher stood in the middle of the rubble that was once his home, picking up a handful of dirt between his fingers as if trying to restore the memory of the place. I thought we were returning to our homes, but we returned to a graveyard of stones. No walls or doors, just rubble and the memories buried beneath it," Abu Maher told the Electronic Intifada. Still determined to stay in their hometown, Abu Maher, like other residents of the town, pitched his tent in front of the ruins of his old home. "If I am destined to live in a tent, let it be on top of the rubble of my home, here in my neighborhood and among my neighbors." He is anxious, he said. He has no idea when reconstruction might begin or if it even will. "I fear that the wait for reconstruction will be long, that we will remain under tents forever, that these ruins will become our new home." That is an excerpt from A Graveyard of Stones by Rasha Abu Jalal on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israel has carried out a series of airstrikes and attacks on Palestinians in the north over the last week. On Wednesday, yesterday, 10 Palestinians were killed in an airstrike on Tamun near Tubas, according to the Wafa news agency. A Palestinian boy was shot and injured by Israeli forces in Tulkarm also on Wednesday, as Israeli soldiers continued a three-day raid into the city. The United Nations reports that access to water and electricity has been disrupted in Tulkarm, and initial estimates suggest nearly 1,000 people have been displaced. On January 27th, Israeli forces carried out several raids around the Ramallah area. Meanwhile, the Israeli siege on Jenin and the Jenin refugee camp has continued for the second week. My colleague Tamara Nassar reported earlier this week that about 2,000 Palestinian families have been forcibly displaced from Jenin as a result of Israel's deadly raid. The Israeli invasion is a continuation of the Palestinian Authority's dirty work in the camp, she adds, which saw the killing of 15 Palestinians, including 3 children, between early December and January 17th, as the Israeli army now, quote, seeks to reach several targets that PA forces have failed to, according to the Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz. The news publication Arabs 48 reports that Israeli forces have expanded their military aggression, driving military vehicles and bulldozers into Jenin, demolishing and burning homes and destroying the local infrastructure. On Tuesday, Israeli forces demolished the Hamza Mosque in Jenin camp and raided Palestinians' homes in preparation for destroying them. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, said on Wednesday that Israeli army forces will continue to occupy Jenin refugee camp. In a video statement, Katz said, quote, "The camp will not return to what it was. Even after the operation ends, Israeli forces will stay to ensure that, quote, terrorism does not return." Israeli soldiers have now killed at least 16 Palestinians and injured and arrested dozens, and at least 100 homes inside the camp have been destroyed, according to local news sources. On Sunday, January 26th, an Israeli sniper shot and killed a 16-year-old child, Adam Majdi Ahmed Sublaban, near the Qalandia checkpoint north of Jerusalem. Defense for Children International Palestine stated that Adam and 2 other children were walking in the area where no tensions were present. Adam was struck in the left thigh from behind, resulting in severe bleeding due to the injury to the femoral artery in the thigh. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces have reportedly arrested 12 Palestinians who celebrated the release of prisoners as part of the Gaza ceasefire. Israel's police and internal spy agency, the Shin Bet, said they arrested them after videos emerged showing them celebrating by waving Hamas flags and firing guns into the air. They alleged that the men violated a ban on expressions of joy and identification with Hamas that has been imposed since the ceasefire in Gaza took hold. The violent arrests in the context of the prohibition on expressions of joy by Israeli forces have prompted the Palestinian Prisoners Society to appeal to international mediators to intervene against, quote, systematic terrorism against released prisoners and their families. According to the prisoners' rights group, Israeli forces have threatened to bomb places where well-wishers of the released prisoners have gathered, while other released prisoners have faced rearrest and detention. On Monday, quote, Israeli forces summoned the released prisoner Ashwaq Awad to meet Israeli intelligence. In this context, the Palestinian Prisoners Society expressed its fears that Israel could rearrest the released prisoners, especially under Military Order No. 1651, which allows this to happen even under exchange deals. On Saturday, January 25th, Israeli forces shot and killed a 2-year-old girl, Leila Mohammed Ayman Khatib, while she ate dinner with her family in their home near Jenin, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. They say that Israeli soldiers shot 4 bullets through the living room window, one of which struck Leila in the back of the head. Leila's grandfather carried her out of the house and brought her to Al Razi Hospital in Jenin, where she received emergency surgery. Leila was pronounced dead around 10 p.m., the rights group stated. Ayad Abu Akhtesh, accountability program director at DCIP, stated, quote, "Israeli forces regularly and routinely carry out military operations with complete contempt for Palestinian life. Little Leila was having dinner with her family when Israeli forces, unprompted, fired live ammunition into their living room, killing her. It is outrageous that the Israeli military has been permitted by world leaders to kill Palestinian children with impunity in flagrant violations of international law." Leila's mother and aunt sustained injuries from the shrapnel during the attack, according to information collected by DCIP. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq stated on Wednesday that, quote, "the genocidal rhetoric and incitement from Israeli officials, which has characterized the atrocities in Gaza, is increasingly applied to all Palestinians. The decades-long failure of the international community and of high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions to stand up against Israel's manifest violations of international law facilitates the climate of impunity by which Israeli authorities are perpetrating its genocidal, colonial violence against the Palestinian people. Al-Haq adds, to put an end to such violence, all states must immediately abide by their obligations under international law, particularly in light of the ICJ advisory opinion of July 2024, requiring that Israel end its illegal presence in and remove settlers from the occupied Palestinian territories. And in Lebanon, Israeli forces have injured dozens of people in the last 4 days, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, which was extended 3 more weeks last weekend after a 60-day truce, the Israeli army was expected to withdraw from southern Lebanon on Sunday. However, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said it would keep soldiers in the country beyond the deadline, Al Jazeera reported. The Reuters news agency reported that Israeli forces killed at least 24 people and wounded more than 140 in southern Lebanon on Sunday and Monday, the Lebanese Health Ministry said, as thousands of people tried to return to their homes in the area in defiance of Israeli military orders. In a speech on Monday, Hezbollah's Secretary General Naim Qassem said that Israel has violated the ceasefire in Lebanon 1,350 times, while the resistance group has upheld it. Quote, we are facing an occupation that continues to attack and refuses to withdraw, and the resistance has the right to determine how, when, and in what form it confronts them, Qassem stated. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing determination and resilience in the aftermath of Israel's 15-month campaign of destruction and genocide. Cats and dogs were among the hundreds of thousands of people and their families returning home to the north. One cat named Busi came with her family to the south and was returning to the north. Her person says, quote, I love her a lot and got attached to her a lot during the war. Another young man holds 3 cats and says they're being returned to the north as well after being fed and looked after. Quote, learn humanity from the Gaza Strip, the man says. And a child with his small dog Lucy smiles as he walks to the north. And finally, our contributor Abu Bakr Abed posted these photos of graffiti along the road where Palestinians marched from the south to the north. The first one says, welcome to the land of the great. Here is Gaza. Number 2 says, greetings to you for what you have endured. The 3rd says, enter in peace and safety. And the 4th one is a line from a famous poem. The hashtags all say the same thing. Here is Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
And thank you, Nora Barrows-Friedman. You hear the podcast, the newscast from the Electronic Intifada every Thursday. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our discussion of what's happening in the age of Trump. We are happy to welcome back to these airwaves a good friend to the show, Professor Ron Lopez. He's faculty and staff at the California State University at Sonoma. Sonoma State University, I should say. And also joining us is our own Miguel Gavilan Molina. Ron Lopez, about a year ago when we last talked, you were sort of in the streets with the students protesting the genocide Trump has now come to office, and there seems to be a bit of change in atmospheric pressure. In fact, I understand there's even appears to be a bit of an attack on the ethnic studies program. Maybe they need to change the name to something else. But welcome back to Flashpoints, and give us a sense of what do you think is going on in terms of the age of Trump? Are people more frightened than they were under Biden? People who are DACA students, for instance? What are your thoughts?
Well, thank you very much for having me back on the program. My thoughts on what's going on right now, yes, the Trump administration and the policies that he's proposing in terms of cutting programs of all kinds and government agencies is very stressful. And community organizations around the country, which includes Sonoma County, are organizing for immigrant defense. And we're going to see how those things play out at places like Sonoma State University. Sonoma State University actually right now, because we're undergoing these massive programmatic cuts, which have been proposed, the main focus is on that. And I think that one of the next steps that we have to look at is to make sure that we protect the vulnerable among us. Trump, among other things, has promised to discontinue DEI or protection for transgender or non-binary persons. And of course, we're committed to maintaining the safety and inclusion and a welcoming environment for all of our students, staff, and faculty of whatever description, which includes persons who are non-binary, persons who are LGBTQ, and of course, immigrant students. But they are proposing at this time to cut a number of programs, including the entire athletics program, the philosophy department, the economics department, a number of educational leadership and other master's degrees, and also the women and gender studies. The ethnic studies programs, which include Chicano and Latino studies, of which I'm a professor, but also American multicultural studies and Native American studies, are going to be forced into a single ethnic studies department. And while that in and of itself is less grave than being discontinued, they are prescribing how we should do that fairly narrowly and giving us sort of a mandate to create a single major, which will be difficult. The different departments have different personalities, and we'll do it. If we're forced to do it, we can do it. But the problem is that this is being done in a way from a top-down managerial cost-cutting perspective without respecting the institutional and the different philosophies of the different programs and the ways in which they manifest and organize the way we present material in different ways. I do think it's possible, but I think we need more flexibility. However, ethnic studies on a national level is looking at this with this moment with great concern, and we do intend to organize and fight back.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Again, that's Professor Ron Lopez. He's at Sonoma State University. And we're talking about, changes. I remember a year ago, there was a lot of activity on your campus. And then I believe one of the major administrators, the president, was fired, and there was a cooling down. I'm wondering if that reaction continues. Are you less free now? Are people fearful? How does this play in the context of undocumented? Is there special precautions people are taking now? Are they planning? Are there organizational meetings? How are people dealing with this?
Well, right now, just to recap, like many other campuses last year, ending in May of last year, we had at Sonoma State a pro-Palestine encampment adjacent to Ruben Salazar Hall. and that, you know, encampment was very well organized. There were no violent incidents like has happened on other campuses. There were very minor provocations that took place, but never escalated beyond some heated words, and only a few times. And the president, Mike Lee, who had previously, you know, he'd come out of retirement to be our president after the departure of the previous president. And he negotiated with us, he and other administrators negotiated with the students in good faith, because it was really a student-led movement with the support of a number of faculty. And he met with the students on a number of occasions, came to an agreement that was comparable to the agreement that came out of San Francisco State University, and then he was immediately forced to resign after having done that. One of the things that I think is instructive in all this is both that the administration was willing to listen and take seriously the concerns and needs of the students, and also that the students' encampment, which was supported by quite a few of the faculty and administrators, was very well organized, and we did not have any of the disruptions, you know, that in some cases around other campuses took place. But also remember, other college presidents and administrators and faculty have been either suspended or forced to resign. As a consequence, in the case of Claudine Gay of Harvard, just being not harsh enough on the protests calling for a ceasefire and calling for divestment from, you know, arms, you know, from the war machine, you know, supporting Israel's military assault on Gaza and the people of Palestine. Now, as to the question of undocumented students, we do have a standing commitment. I have not myself been a member of any meetings on that subject, but since you brought it up, I will make sure to participate in those meetings going forward, and I will report back to you when I do.
Beautiful. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Also joining us is our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina, who has been keeping an eye on the raids and the responses coming through the Trump administration. Of course, Miguel, we know that Obama was no prize. Clinton was no prize when it comes to all of this and to deportations. And Biden was vicious around deportation. And Kamala Harris was no prize either. But Miguel, your thoughts and your questions for Professor Lopez.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Professor, for being with us. My big concern and what I fear the most is that the fascist Trump has just, you know, appointed people to his cabinet, and he's assigned her last name is McMahon, the wife of the WWF World Wrestling Federation tycoon, and you know, to be head of the Department of Education. And there is this long talk and rumbling between those, that circle, and Elon Musk, the Mr. Efficiency in government, to do away with the Department of Education. That said, that threat, and then also the possibility of the, you know, federal freezing funds, you know, to states and to groups that weren't in support of his campaign or behind his, you know, election. That's really troubling, that the fact that, you know, that's potentially could happen. And how I know today you had an action, the labor action, you know, to start, you know, addressing those concerns, because there's going to be budget cuts up and down the state and across the country. But how are those potential threats by the Trump administration on doing away with the Department of Education and freezing funds to states and the, you know, campuses, be it, you know, California University or, you know, state universities or junior colleges? Are you talking about this? Is this something you're preparing to address, Ron?
Very much so, although like the action today, which had faculty, staff, and students, we had a rally of 1,500 people, about 1,500 persons in Seawolf Plaza, which is between the student center and the recreation center, during a town hall that was originally supposed to be in person, but interim president Emily Kircher decided to move it onto an online forum. So, you know, they did their spiel and people called in regarding these programmatic cuts, which are very quite extensive. Now, as to what's going to happen on a more statewide and national scale, I think it, in a place like Sonoma State, where we're under the sort of immediate attack, one analysis that I saw is that Donald Trump is throwing so much stuff at us that, it, you know, we're sort of overwhelmed. And so one of the strategies for responding to these kinds of dynamics, these kinds of situations, is that we have to keep our heads about us and not be overwhelmed and respond in intelligent but militant and forceful way. And by forceful, I do not mean physically forceful, but I mean organizing forcefully and effectively against these unjust and frankly unwise attacks on our public institutions, not just education, but many of our public institutions. As for the idea of putting someone who's not an educational professional and doesn't even really have any appropriate experience in any way in charge of education or health and human services or any of these departments is a frightening precedent. But one of the things to keep in mind is that the American people voted for this. And were they fooled? Were they entertained? This is a question that I haven't quite answered for myself yet, but I know that we have 4 years of organizing ahead of us, and I think that the institutional damage that is being done will be fairly extensive. So we have to organize, and in many cases, we're going to have to set aside differences that we have with other people to organize as a common cause to maintain some of our public institutions. And be able to rebuild at the end of this 4 year period, assuming that we don't end up with a Vance presidency, which I think is going to happen in about a year and a half or 2 years.
Professor Lowe,
one of the things, for example, that's emblematic or an example symbolic of this larger problem is trying to rename the Gulf of Mexico. Everywhere in the world, every other country is going to continue to call the Gulf of Mexico by its proper name. And the fact that the United States and now Google is going along with this, so when you open up a map, apparently now it's being called the Gulf of America, this is the kind of ridiculousness that makes the United States look foolish. But in addition, an educated person, a person from the United States going to say, Europe or Asia or any other part of the world and saying, oh, yes, the Gulf of America, this is a laughable thing. And it's the kind of foolhardy, silly, symbolic, political maneuver that's designed to sort of, spark some interest. But it's emblematic of this larger lack of seriousness about how can we govern. And the sad part is that, the people did vote these folks into office, Trump and some of the other Republicans. And more recently, we've seen some of the Democrats going along with some of these confirmations. So we have a lot of work to do.
Ron, why is ethnic studies more important now than ever? What's at the heart of the matter there?
We live in a complex society that has a lot of moving parts, and one of the historical legacies of the United States and the Western world in general is both the era of colonization and settler colonialism around the world in North and South America, New Zealand, Australia, Israel, and we have to have an understanding of how these systems and the system of racial stratification, the systems of slavery and racial hierarchy shaped our world and also continue to impact our world and the life chances of individuals and the world that we live in. Unless we acknowledge some of the challenges that we've inherited, because a person is not at fault for what happened 5 years ago. But if you're a privileged person, if you're privileged with whiteness or inherited wealth, you may not be at fault for it, but you're still responsible for what you do now in that situation. And those of us who are in the position of being with less power or being descendants of slaves or the subjugated and conquered, we also have responsibility to be aware and to fight for justice for all people. And this is why I really want to emphasize, we need to build solidarity among all of our communities and work together for the betterment of all of us, for a better world and a better future for the generations to come.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right there. Professor Ron Lopez, Sonoma State University, fighting for ethnic studies, fighting for always for his students. I'm Dennis Berenstay with Miguel Gavilan-Molina. Thank you, Professor Lopez, for taking the time out. Please keep us posted as these things unfold.
Thank you, Miguel, and thank you, Dennis.
You're very welcome, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a break and then turn our attention to Haiti, the Haitian people, and the unbelievable suffering that's going on inside of Haiti because of the U.S. policies, not just Trump either. Stay with us.
Dennis, you still there?
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As you know, we never take our eyes off Haiti. Haiti has been brutalized by U.S. policies for decades, destabilization policies, policies that sort of undermine the possibility for self-determination. Haiti is often referred to as the poorest nation in the hemisphere. Well, it's definitely rich in resources, but the people are poor, and the U.S. policies of destabilization that have dominated the hemisphere have brought incredible suffering to the Haitian people. But we have drumbeat coverage, and we continue our coverage today with Robert Roth. He is a co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee. He knows a great deal about Haiti. He's a human rights activist as well. Robert Roth, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Why don't you, a lot of people are frightened with Trump now in charge. It hasn't been a picnic for Haitians with the prior presidents, but it seems like there's a particular stain and disdain and a powerful movement to deport as many people as possible. And Haitians are sort of front and center in that, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, there's, you know, as we know from the Trump administration's prior term in office and from Trump's comments about Haitians, which have been absolutely crude, racist, and despicable, we know that, and, you know, all the nonsense that they created about Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, we know that Haitians are a prime target for deportation. And, you know, this could, you know, involve tens of thousands you know, probably more Haitians who were on the firing line, really, for the Trump deportation policy. And I wanted to just say that the same thing is happening in the Dominican Republic, where over 270,000 Haitians have been deported just this year alone in, you know, like a totally targeted, violent attack on the Haitian population, which has, you know, been doing work just like migrants here that have helped to make the companies in the Dominican Republic rich, and they're under attack right now as well. So yes, this is a worldwide phenomenon, and Haitians are a primary target, no doubt.
And we saw the announcement about Guantanamo. We know that Trump has a particular hatred, he has expressed it, for Haitians and people in the region. They're talking about as many as 30,000 going to Guantanamo back and forth, you know, in front of Cuba there. You think a lot of Haitians are going to end up in nowhere land just because they're Haitian?
Well, quite possibly. I mean, they did it to Haitians before in the 90s, you know, when they classified all Haitian migrants as carriers of the AIDS virus and, you know, sequestered them in Guantanamo. And there were big fights. And Haiti Action Committee was part of that to end that, you know. And I think absolutely Haitians, again, are primary targets of this white supremacist move to deport as many migrants as possible. And obviously it doesn't just involve Haitians, but in this period, we have to make alliances with all of the communities that are facing this. And that's our intention in the next period of time, to connect, you know, these various attacks on different communities of color. And make a really strong resistance against these policies as they come down one after the other in the new Trump administration.
Robert, talk a little bit about what kinds of things can be done. Maybe begin, though. Remind people how dangerous things are on the ground in Haiti. No one would be surprised, people trying to leave the country again. And it has a lot to do with U.S. policy and U.S. control in the region.
Yes, it does. I mean, this is approaching 21 years after the coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and his Lavalas movement, which was bringing progressive change to Haiti. And if you look at the results of over 20 years of foreign occupation and one illegitimate government after another that has been oppressing the Haitian people, you have what Haitians are calling a hell on earth right now inside Haiti. And like, so for example, Haiti now has the highest level of internal displacement due to what is, you know, euphemistically called as crime-related violence in the world. And over 1 million Haitians have been displaced due to what we call death squad violence. And these death squads have been empowered by the same governments that the U.S. has installed in Haiti. And in this year alone, over 5,000 people have been killed by paramilitary forces led by a death squad coalition called Vive Ensemble, which poses as a revolutionary force, but has attacked one poor neighborhood after another. We just heard from grassroots activists in Haiti with a listing of public schools, hospitals, pharmacies, markets that have been burned and destroyed. And it is very difficult for Haitians to even go on the streets or travel to markets. The food situation as a result is cataclysmic. I heard a Haitian activist interviewed on your program by Kevin Pina, a short while ago who said that eating is a luxury right now in Haiti. And over 5.4 million Haitians are considered, again, these are euphemisms, acutely food insecure, which means close to starvation, with Haiti already being designated by the UN as a famine hotspot of the highest concern. There was just a human rights report done by the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which details the incredible human rights violations that have gone on. And, you know, to add one more thing to that, the gender violence, the violence against women and children that have been committed by these paramilitaries is absolutely appalling. It has gone up by like 1,000% over the last few years. And, you know, these are really vulnerable populations that are under attack. You know, and I was listening to Nora Barrows Friedman's report from Gaza, and you could apply some of those same, you could say some of the same things, unfortunately, about the situation in Haiti, which Haitian activists have called a slow-moving genocide. And really, that's what's happening in Haiti. And again, this is all under the aegis of U.S.-imposed regimes, one after another, since the overthrow of the Aristide government.
And to be clear, the United States government is playing a role, powerful role in what's going on, in who is a part of, who's going to be the leadership in Haiti. And this is an old story where the United States is never, apparently, no matter how, it's amazing, the big United States of America is not going to give up, is not going to allow the Haitian people the power of self-determination, and if there ever was a people that wanted it. The U.S. is playing a key role here, right? They are calling the shots. Oh, yeah. They're bringing in the Kenyans, and that was questionable about their background and their human rights record, and this is all the U.S., right?
Yes. Well, it's the U.S. and a grouping of foreign occupiers called the Core Group, you know, which includes the European Union, the UN, the OAS, and other individual countries, right, which have been dominating Haitian politics for decades now. And what they have produced in their wake is a country with no elected officials at all, with a human rights crisis that's right up among the world's worst, and, you know, with a government that is like now dominated by the same right-wing forces that were installed after Aristide was overthrown. And, you know, we work very closely in solidarity with Fami Lavalas, Aristide's, you know, political party. And, you know, they are like trying to have an impact on this current transitional government, but they're a minority within it. And, you know, every move that they make to try to actually fight against the paramilitary or to demand restitution from France or to condemn the Trump administration's migrant policies are met with strong opposition from the U.S. State Department. And that was true under Biden as well. I mean, the Biden administration deported more Haitians than any other administration in U.S. history, well over 25,000. Yes. And we can expect worse from Trump. You know, so Haiti has to be part of the center of our, you know, of any anti-imperialist movement and strategy right now, connecting it with what's going on in Palestine or, you know, the attacks that we can imagine that are going to go against, you know, Mexico or Venezuela or Cuba. These attacks on Haitians are part and parcel of that policy.
And we can't forget, which American president was it that created the policy to kidnap the duly elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, kidnap him and undermine the flow of democracy in Haiti just as it was beginning again? Who was that?
Yes, well, that was George That was George W. Bush in 2004, who has, you know, been now reclaimed as a so-called moderate, you know, yeah. Republican. And his father that was, you know, that orchestrated the first coup against the Aristide government. So this is a longstanding U.S. policy. I would just point out that this is the 200th anniversary of the French surrounding the newly independent Haitian Republic in 1825 and demanding and, you know, in fact, enacting reparations against the Haitian government that amounted to over $21 billion for the Haitian crime of freeing themselves from slavery and colonialism. So this goes way, way back, you know, and of course, U.S. banks took over that debt and reinforced it for another 100 years. So, you know, this is part and parcel of ongoing attacks against, you know, democracy in Haiti.
It's amazing. It really is so troubling. I remember, thanks to, you mentioned Kevin Pina, who is a contributor, a senior contributor to this show. And I believe it was 1994 that Kevin helped me get to Haiti, and I had a chance to walk next to President Aristide through Cité Soleil. And it was so extraordinary because he didn't need any security. It would have been impossible to hurt him. He was a beloved leader. He had just gotten back in the country, and it wasn't long before. But the United States government is somehow can't stand this tiny Haiti, determined to have self-determination. They won't let it happen. They won't let it happen. What is this? Why?
I was in Haiti for President Aristide's return from forced exile in 2011, and that same unbelievable support was evidenced as thousands and thousands of the poorest Haitians in Port-au-Prince like climbed the walls of the compound in which he was gonna live and stayed for hours and hours chanting. And, you know, you can imagine if that had happened in the United States with people climbing over the walls to the White House, right? They would have all been shot. But here, the people were welcomed by, you know, by a administration that actually was one with the people. And that's what people in Haiti are trying to redo today, you know. And the main issue right now is the security issue in Haiti, because when you can't go to market, when you can't, you know, have your children go to school, when you can't go to a pharmacy, when a hospital is being attacked and burned down, you need to defend your communities. And that's what Haitians are beginning to do in, you know, in response to these paramilitary attacks. There is a lot of self-defense going on in Haiti because people need to protect themselves against these rampaging paramilitary forces that are connected to the oligarchy in Haiti and the sectors of the government.
We're out of time, but I want to thank you, Robert Roth, for helping us think about Haiti and making sure we understand what's happening on the ground and who's responsible. Obviously, there's a lot more to come. Thanks for taking the time out to be with us on Flashpoints. Really appreciate it.
I just, like, if people, we're going to be doing an event this Sunday, and it's called Caribbean Dialogue and Haiti Action Committee in solidarity with Haiti, militarism in the Caribbean. And people can find out about it at www.haitisolidarity.net. Thanks as always, Dennis.
Thank you.
Vigilance isn't a choice.
It's a responsibility. At KPFA, we remain watchful. Through shifting tides, through crises and uncertainty, we stand as a constant, investigating, reporting, amplifying the voices of truth and justice. We don't turn away from the hard questions.
We confront them.
We don't follow the narrative.
We challenge it.
Because in times like these, vigilance is the difference between knowing and being kept in the dark. KPFA.
Vigilant, as always.
The people have the power to redeem the work of fools. This is 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, online everywhere at kpfa.org.